Welcome to the Huntsville Macintosh Users Group June 2007 informal meeting.
Does anybody have anything that they'd like to bring up or is left over from that?
I don't think we had any urgent business that was tabled for the informal meeting, so
okay.
There are one or two things we'll probably bring up next formal meeting.
Okay, good. That's all that we have in the way of
business.
Or anything at an informal meeting, so we can have our choice. We can have flashes, or Marius can.
Well, I think let's start with flashes. We have some information. If you looked at the email that you got last night about today's meeting, obviously the topic is the information about Leopard that was brought out, or maybe not brought out, at the WWDC keynote a week and a half ago. There are supposedly 300 new features in Leopard, of which we knew of a handful already from last year, and there are two new features that they told us about this year. So they're still keeping us in suspense what most of these new features are. So we'll try to talk about what we know, which is mighty little today, but I think let's talk about or go over to flashes first and see if there's anything people have problems with or want to know about.
Is Leopard going to be 10.5 or 11?
10.5. Yeah. Apropos OS 10, 10.4.10 came out this last week, and those of you that love running software update, you might have noticed there was yet another update last night. There's another security patch for basically Safari and the web underpinnings of OS X that came out yesterday. Definitely worth downloading because it is a security issue. If you don't have that and happen to stumble upon a malicious website, under normal circumstances, it's no big deal, but there are just so many possible ways of exploiting an application running on the internet, so Apple has been busily patching. It sort of brings up one of the few non-Apple issues from the Worldwide Developer Conference, namely that Apple now is making Safari for Windows. And of course, Windows being that buggy something or another that it is, anybody writing software for it is bound to have lots of bugs. Apple not excluded from that list. So Safari, within a day of being released for Windows, had several dozen known bugs. So Apple is now to Safari version 3.02 in the beta world. They also released that last night for OS 10, 3.02 revision, which if you're running the beta, which actually happens to be running behind us here, Safari 3.02, doesn't look all that different from Safari 2 from Tiger, but it has some hidden features that I have yet to play with that are kind of nice.
Right. The best one I like out of it is the finding feature when you're searching
on a page. Mm-hmm. And another one is tabs that you can rearrange. Doesn't sound like a big deal, but the cool thing is that you can actually tear a tab right off the page, make it a new window if you want to. It's kind of hard to do with a small screen like I have here, but you know, they're cute little features. They're also in the debug mode. If you have a debug mode installed, which I do, if I find a link, let's see here, there is a new inspector which allows you to dig down into, of course, doesn't work very well on a black website like Apple's, but it lets you dig down into the structure of those links and is much improved over what was there under the old version. Actually, I find out that there's an even better version already under construction of this. But if you're a webmaster, this is a lovely tool. But as I said, the WebKit folks have actually made an even better version of that.
Can you repeat what you said about the tabs?
Well, let's see here. If I have tabs, let's go to... we'll see how quickly this loads or doesn't load, depending on our network's feelings for the day. Okay, under Firefox, you could do this before. You could drag one tab to the other side. You couldn't do this in old Safari. But let me make this window a little smaller. And believe me, I have not done this before, so this may break, this may not happen. But I should be able to rip this off, and I guess I have yet to figure out how to do that.
Okay.
Oh, that's interesting.
So you're saying...
Why it's reloading is beyond me, because it was already loaded. This is doing all sorts of weird things, but notice... that's my laptop. It has nothing to do with Safari. The touchpad is really sensitive, and it sometimes... I don't know why that doesn't work. Well, maybe it doesn't.
Bring it down. Slide down.
Oh, there it goes. Okay, thank you for that hint.
Yeah.
because I had never done it before. That's, you know.
Just pull it up in a new window.
Yeah, and theoretically, there's a way of bringing it back. I don't even have a clue how to do that.
I don't remember
saying that. There were some bugs associated with that, too. Of course, remember, if you do download Safari 3, it is a beta. Okay? Everybody expects software, when it gets posted, to be bulletproof and the final version. Believe me, when they say beta, they mean beta. Okay? So I don't have this on the machine that I do my everyday work on. I keep this on my laptop, so I have the Windows version on machines that run Windows, like under Parallels on my Mac Pro at home or one of the machines on campus. But I don't put it on the machine I use for everyday work, because the old version is still a bit more stable. Okay, but nonetheless, it's faster and has a lot of, you know... it's sort of a preview of what's coming up next.
Well, I'll tell you something, too. I work out with Army base, and the new Safari 3 did fix a lot of bugs that Tune does not support. And, I mean, I can now get pages that look should be looking correctly, and all that, but the Army
Yeah,
it does look better for us.
It still hasn't fixed the broken Oracle portal at campus.
Oh, the Oracle.
That thing is just dreadful. Fortunately, we're about to dump the thing, so I'm not too concerned about it. It's just a pain to update the web pages on that, because you end up having to... It puts this one-line comment when you load a page. Hit refresh to reload this page. Sometimes I have to do it 10 times or go back and... try the link again before the thing properly loads. It is atrocious.
I am looking for a plugin for Crystal Reports for Safari. Anybody knows about it? I've been looking for everything.
Could you say what Crystal Reports is?
It's a package that allows you to. It was a package that was built on Windows Box.
Mm-hmm.
But all it does is it's almost like a PDF viewer. It actually outputs it to a window.
Mm.
And I have not yet found the capability of doing that.
Huh. Yeah.
Speaking of, you know, bugs in Safari, of course, a lot of us, you know, use our browsers for banking, buying things, photo uploads, and stuff,
right.
Or digital cameras. This day before yesterday, I went to Sam's. I was in a real hurry because I was going to meet someone. I had to show him some pictures I had just taken hours before, the Sam's photo site, which I've used many times, would give me the option to store pickup. Long story short, I got on the phone with Sam's web IT, and This work now is not work when you change. No, no, sir. You should use Explorer. That's typical answer. I said, no, I've tried Firefox this morning, I've tried Safari, but I wanted you to get this thing working. Right. The guy stayed on the phone with me for about 40 minutes, said, I really need these pictures, and I was on my way to meet this guy, and he did it. And but that just goes to show you that no matter what version of your browser you have, Safari, that things worked yesterday, someone on the our website changes something, it not work.
Needless to say, that item up there in your menu bar called Report Bugs to Apple, if you run into a website that doesn't work correctly, you know, and it's a popular site, not some Joe Schmo site somebody put together that has no relevance to 99.59s of the internet. Yeah, but if it's a major site, you definitely want to know, let Apple know about it and let them figure out how to fix it. You know.
The question is, when do you report things to Apple versus the website, them just not accommodating something to some standard that Safari should meet?
Well, let's put it this way. There is the real web standards, and then there are the de facto standards. Okay? And the real ones are put out by Tim Berners-Lee and WC3.org. Apple conforms to those quite well, thank you. And then there is the de facto standard put out by Redmond Washington, okay, which has nothing to do with real standards. It is Microsoft proprietary. Okay, and because Microsoft has 90% market share, they can damn well do what they wish. And so, therefore, just because you know, the standard says A, Microsoft may be doing B. And since 90% of the browsers are supposed to do B, the webmasters will be designing the website to do B. Okay, not caring about the real standards, they'll just do whatever it takes so it renders properly on Internet Explorer. So the real problem is, what is the HTML code and the back end on that web server doing? Well, the answer is, unless you have access to the server and dig into the source code or even deeper, you really can't tell. I mean, the source code you can look up. If there's a statement that says Internet Explorer this, Safari that, Firefox that, then perhaps you might want to contact the webmaster. But if there's nothing in there that you can tell what's going on, you're kind of in trouble. And, you know, as I said, the back end part, what happens is that, remember, your web browser puts out some signature, okay, of what it is, what client, what operating system, some other information that may or may not be useful. Well, guess what? Smart web servers will take that header information and give you an appropriate web page for that. So you may be seeing the Safari web page, okay, and it may be dumbed down because that webmaster just didn't know how to do it right for the Mac, okay. Whereas you bring up the Internet Explorer page, it may have all the ActiveX and all that foolishness that Microsoft does, features that enhance it. Okay, yeah.
I had a similar thing. There's Bill Bennett has a Mornings in America. You can subscribe to it and you can get live feeds from 5 to 8 in the morning, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been working fine, and then all of a sudden I could not get a live feed. And been in touch with the website.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I can do now, once the day is over and I've created an MP3 file, I can
download the podcast, but not the stream.
Right. And I've been on the phone with them and on the email. They say, don't have this, don't have this. Everything that they've said, I haven't really been either using or had on my computer.
Right.
But it's just basically laying there right before. But I never did send in a report to Apple.
Right. Well, I'm not sure that in the case of a live feed, it is Apple's problem. Okay.
What format is it in? Is it MP3 or MP4A or something like that? Or is it some Windows proprietary? You know, if you're using Windows Media Player, well, see, there's the problem. Windows Media Player for the Mac is no longer being supported by Microsoft directly. There's a third party that's taken over generating plugins that work with QuickTime so you can play Windows Media Player. But guess what? You're always going to be half a generation behind what Microsoft is doing. And if the guys are generating, you know, want to be up on the bleeding edge of the tool, they're going to be using the latest, greatest codecs and things from Microsoft, for which there may not be an Apple QuickTime plugin. And you're sort of in trouble. Billy, you want to say something?
The audio that he's probably talking about has probably got an ASPX extension. If it has the ASPX extension, Flip for Mac, which is a Microsoft plugin for the Macintosh, they bought that company, will work with the Mac in QuickTime, and it will play all of the streaming stuff live.
That's the one plugin that they said make sure you have.
Well, I'll tell you right now, it does work. Don't just ignore all these people that say...
Microsoft says use that. I mean, Microsoft, if you go into Microsoft's website and want to find out about Windows Media Player for the Mac, it points you to Flip for Mac. Okay, because that is the officially sanctioned solution for Microsoft. Okay, so, yeah, try that. If that doesn't work, it's not going to happen, period.
Reason why is a lot of the radio stations like WBNN and WUNP and all them, they're all based, if you click them, it comes up into this Microsoft Windows thing that immediately you can't run it on the Mac, but if you go install Flip for Mac, it immediately transforms that window to a white screen, then it pulls it up to an audio.
Well, that's what it does on, that's what it does on the MP3 archive.
Yeah, it does that too.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
I had something strange happen. We were in Italy, took some pictures, and I loaded it in and tried to download it to the computer. And the memory worked for almost all of them, but there are four pictures in the middle of the set that will not load. And I can go back and put it in the memory card of the camera and look through it, and there it is. And someone explained what's...
So it shows up when you have the card in the camera, but it does not show up when you try to transfer it into the computer, or the computer just styles on that.
But everything before it and everything after it is there.
Okay, have you downloaded everything before it and after it to the computer? You might want to go through and delete those things that you've already transferred.
And just do it.
Or have you just tried, instead of going into iPhoto, I'm assuming you're using iPhoto to transfer, just get out of iPhoto and open up the drive directly on the hard drive, because it mounts on the desktop just like any other mechanism. And then see if you can just drag it over, just copy file from the memory card to the hard drive, and then see if you can double-click it. Well, after he's down.
Yeah, after he's downloaded.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with.
Format your memory cards often.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I completely agree with that. Memory card, is prone to errors. And, you know, they're also prone to last a finite amount of time. You know, it's not like all of us go out, shoot a full card every day for year after year. So the reality is the memory cards have enough cycles in them that your odds are you're not going to have a camera that works with that memory card at a time where the memory card actually fails. Okay, so it's not a real big deal, but they're good for about 2,000 cycles.
Okay. Yeah, I had a similar thing happen. A friend of mine gave me a CD that had photos downloaded from his memory card. And if there were 15 on there, I would come across two or three that something corrupted the file. Mm. And if I got to looking at it, these files had maybe, I don't know, 4.5 or 40 gigs or 40 megs, and the actual picture should have been like 450. Mm. They were always smaller than you could tell. Perfect. To look at it, looks perfectly normal.
That, those are some very large sizes for a photo. I mean, typical photos.
Ten.
Yeah.
That's in
I mean, I'm thinking myself, uncompressed 10 megapixel. Yeah. I mean, that's
that's
30 megs.
Yeah, let me back off on the size.
But we get the point. The point is that the size of the pictures that you had on the CD is much smaller than the size should have been. That's the key here. It doesn't matter what the actual numbers are. Okay. Well, I don't know. If it's much smaller and you see a picture when you open it up, but it doesn't have all the information, the only thing I can think of is that it's storing a thumbnail type resource, which is a much smaller res version of the same thing. And you've just lost the full res.
Well, this didn't even open up.
Oh, it didn't open at all?
It didn't open at all.
Well, then you've got a corrupted file.
The pictures I'm talking about will not show up as being downloaded at all.
Right, in iPhoto.
There's a total skip of those four pictures.
Right.
Then when I take, disconnect it from the computer and go to the camera,
Right. Yeah. As I said, try downloading it without iPhoto. Just copying it over the hard drive and then double-clicking the file once it's on the hard drive and see what happens. It should open it up in preview, which has nothing to do with iPhoto. And you should be able to see it. If it shows up in preview, then just take those four files while you have iPhoto open and just drag it into iPhoto, and they'll be added to your library. Yes.
Larry mentioned last time about some G4 iBooks.
Mm-hmm.
Will that operate Photoshop?
Well, depends which version. CS2, sure. I mean, it'll work on CS3 as well. It's just your mileage may be variable in terms of speed.
Yeah.
I mean, quite honestly, I've Photoshop CS3. And I'm running on a Mac Pro, and I'm not exactly impressed in its speed. You know, yeah, granted, I'm dealing with some really large maps and stuff like that, but I'm still sitting there with a 4% processor machine. You know, it's like, well, my problem is I don't have enough RAM in the machine. But seriously, that's the thing here. It's how much RAM do you have? Okay, the processor is really secondary of importance in Photoshop, unless you're doing really complex filtering, in which case you have to be patient regardless. Okay, but the more RAM you can put into a computer, the better. Okay, and for Photoshop, nothing beats RAM. Because remember, you need 3 times as much RAM typically as the picture that you're working on has size. Okay, so if you have a 1 meg file, you need 3 megs. Obviously, pictures these days have gotten a little bit bigger.
I have Impecunia's grandson who's interested. Mm-hmm. He's talking about, I'm not sure what he wants to do, and maybe Elements would do it, but he needs, I don't know.
Odds are it would. Mm-hmm. It's a lot cheaper. And for learning, especially for somebody at that age, I don't know what your grandson. Oh, okay. See, grandson, you could be the size, or it could be adult. In this case, it's adult. Okay. Well, there, it's harder to say.
Well, it depends on what he wants to do.
That's right. But if he hasn't used Photoshop before, then
he has.
Okay. Well, then you might want to go. Yeah. Well, it does make a difference. You might want to give him the real thing. If somebody isn't accustomed to photo editing tools like Photoshop, then I would start with Elements. But the point about Elements is that the current version doesn't exist for the Mac. Okay, so there's a newer version for Windows than there is for the Mac. So whereas the real thing expensive as it is, the latest greatest version is available. I don't know when it.
Found some with the Mac, and he likes to use it. Uh-huh. He likes to get it instead of use the PC.
Yeah. Well, quite honestly, if that's his plan, I would spend a few dollars more and get a MacBook.
Yeah.
That way you have. It is, but you also have the Intel, and you can run Windows on it if he so desires. He can run the latest, greatest software. You can put a lot more RAM in there than that G4. No. Yes, sir?
Last meeting, I came to you guys inform me that I probably didn't have near enough RAM in G5.
Right.
I had 512.
Right.
So I upped it to 1.25 gig.
Okay.
And I also learned about activity monitor.
Right.
Here. So I've been watching the pie chart.
Right.
Put it in my dock. It shows, among other things, available memory.
Uh-huh.
When I start a big project, video project,
uh-huh,
it goes from about 225 degrees, eventually up to about, looks like 10 or something, which seemed alarming to me. Didn't know what was going on. Somewhere in there, I read that, this is what my question is, if you mm-hmm. can expand on this a little bit. I guess if you don't restart the computer, if you want to go back to that project, that information that is in RAM at that time, which I assume is reflected by the pie chart thing,
mm-hmm.
can make like reburning a DVD, burning a new DVD, for instance,
uh-huh.
quicker. What's happening?
Hmm. Lip, any ideas on that one?
If I restart the Mac,
yeah.
go back.
Oh, sure. Sure, but you know, if you look at what's going on the machine right now, I've got an X resource graph running here. Very little going on this machine right now because all I'm running essentially is it and Safari. But if you let me see here, if I can't bring up a little bit more geeky information. This is really what's going on. That's all these tools are actually plugging into this. It's called Top, and it gives you information about what's going on, how much things are using.
But more
well, I know it is. But the information about memory and so forth is on that on the top portion there, on the second to last line, actually last two lines. And that tells you about the usage of memory, how much is wired, active, inactive, and how much is used and free. Notice I've got about 1.25 gigs free right now, physical memory. And you also see that I've got virtual memory set up at about 4.5 gigs. But it's this page in and page out part that we were discussing last time. Okay, that's how much memory is being swapped from the RAM into the hard drive as virtual memory and back. Okay, you want to keep that as small as possible because that's what you were filling up. See, the way the operating system is, it says, I've got this memory. He wants to do something. Well, let me put it into RAM. Okay, but you keep on putting stuff in there, and eventually RAM runs out. And that's when it starts using the virtual memory, basically the hard drive. And that's where you slow down. And there's nothing much you can do about clearing out this page swapping deal between physical memory and hard drive except rebooting. Because the operating system doesn't know what is more important to you. It says, I need space. And it looks at the processes that are running, which ones are highest priority. Those stay in RAM. So if you have a disk image, it's probably fairly low priority because it's only used when you're burning the disk. So it gets thrown to hard drive first. See, whereas a program that's running like Safari in this case, it'll be sitting in physical RAM because that's going on right now. It needs that information because that's code is it's executing. So it prioritizes. But the truth of the matter is, the operating system, that's the whole reason for operating system, is smart enough to do this in a sane manner. You really don't shouldn't have to be worrying about this.
Are you saying that I can't just add this new RAM? I could, I mean, but if I want to take advantage of it, I need to learn how to manage it?
No, that's my point. The operating system is doing that for you. But what I'm saying is, its standard procedure is to fill up physical RAM first. When it runs out of that, it starts using virtual memory. In general, that is supposed to be completely transparent to the user, and it's smart enough, fast enough to deal with it. You shouldn't even think about it. But the more physical RAM you have, the more it can keep in physical RAM, and hence the better your computer is going to perform.
Have you looked at the CPU?
A little bit.
Is it plenty of space, plenty of unused CPU?
No, maybe I don't want to talk about that.
No, part of activity.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at this column where I'm got the pointer here, the CPU column. I guess I should have highlighted the CPU rather than the percent sign. Notice this process that we're actually looking at is using roughly 10% of the machine, and the X resource graph back here is using another couple to 5%. But when you add those things together, that gives you the CPU load. Oops, I should have not. Let me get rid of this here. Gives you this chart here up on top. That's your CPU load. Now, you can see it's running right now at about 19%. Now, if it's running 19%, that's happy. When your CPU is running at 100% and your load, let me see if I can't put some white background on this. Let me just hide this guy here. Just use this as a white background for that. Make it a little bit easier to see. Now, the load right here, that item right here, is what matters. Okay, 1.0 means your CPU is running at 100% capacity. Now, if you have a dual processor machines, it'll be 2.0. If you have a four processor machine, it'd be 4.0. Okay? But the point is, however many cores your machine has times 1 is the maximum it can actually do. Now, this number can be greater than 1. Okay? I had, for instance, on my web server on campus, a dual processor G4 Xserve, I had a load of 8. Well, two processor load of 8, that means 4 times as much load as the processor can handle. Something is not going to work very well here. Okay, I figured out what code was at fault, and I fixed it, and now it's running at point something, which is where it's supposed to be. Okay, and so you definitely want to check that load. If that gets to greater than 1, or if you have a dual processor machine like your G5 tower, typically 2 processors, well, if it's greater than 2, your CPU is overworked, and it's doing something more than it can handle.
And these page-in, page-outs are taking up CPU.
It takes CPU, it takes bandwidth.
Overmanage that,
yeah.
And you peg that with CPU.
Right. But it's also just bandwidth between the various components. You have bandwidth between the RAM and the CPU, between the CPU and the hard drive. The latter of which is your real bottleneck, because the hard drive is much lower bandwidth than is your RAM. Tom?
What command did you use in terminology?
Top.
What?
Top.
TOP. How did you get that?
TOP.
Is that monitor?
It's called terminal. It lives under utilities. Terminal. This guy right here. No. This guy right here, that's X resource graph.
Yeah, it's X resource graph.
Where is it?
you download that from the internet. If you just put XRG in the Google search, okay, could go a little faster here, I admit.
Could you pull up Activity Monitor?
And it's GauchoSoft. It comes up the first. Activity Monitor I don't like because it's a little slower. It's more resource intensive.
But I just wanted to show
a
very simple block graph that shows CPU usage.
Right.
Like I've at times with other computers been limited in terms of the actual processing of DVD rather than burning. And could look at that thing and I see the thing is just 100% all one. You don't see any open black spot. But I know I'm limited inside the CPU line. When I upgraded, that left that less than the capacity. But if you use something like Handbrake, when you're trying to break down the DVD, you'd see that peg go all over the bottom. I think those things in combination.
Yeah. I mean, you can look at these things separately. And this is the system memory that we were talking about earlier. It's just another way of seeing the same thing that XRG is showing, or TOP for that matter, if you know how to read it. Because they're essentially all looking at the same information that the kernel has and displaying it real time. And actually, I was looking at Apple's website this morning trying to get a few things ready for the meeting, and I stumbled upon the information about the developer tools for 10.5, and they have an even nicer setup for that. It's called X-Ray, which allows you to actually go back and replay what happened, not just look at it real time. So, but that's another story for another time. I don't have that yet, so I really don't want to talk about it. All right. Yes, sir.
You've used the word client, and I've always wondered what that means.
Client?
What's a client? I know what a client is for a lawyer, but what's a client on a computer?
Ah. Well, there's a server, and there's a client. Okay. So...
The client of the server.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, for example, Safari is a web client. Okay. For example, if I go back to, here are the one-day statistics for the HMUX server. And if I scroll down a long way, here we have the list of browsers. Well, that information, the various web browsers that are hitting our website, that's the client information. That information the web server receives, in this case I also log it, doesn't have to be logged, but if I have a smart back end on the server, I can decide on what I'm going to serve to the client based on that string. Okay. So, and as you can see, one of our most frequent clients are the search engines, Google and Yahoo, and some other bots. They love chopping up through our website, believe me. Yeah, well, actually, here's the breakout by operating system. You can
Windows
see...
Windows 3.1?
I was thinking the same thing when I saw that. BOS? Atari?
Atari!
There's our great Atari man back there, Billy. Isn't that amazing? Somebody within the last 24 hours has hit our web server using an Atari box.
Is that even Symbian?
Yeah.
Symbian's okay.
Symbian isn't completely dead yet, but but some of these other ones, you know.
You don't have any Amigas on
there. No, I haven't seen those in a while. Let's Well, Amiga doesn't count as another Unix. Let me look at the all-time log, if you want to see that, just for fun. Hello.
Folks, are we lucky this man is running our website or what, huh?
There we go. That's sort of the distribution. Oh, yeah, it's there. OS 2, Web TV, RISC OS, and yep, a few more Atari hits. And yeah, Windows 16-bit. I don't even want to guess what that was. Windows 2.0 or something?
It was 16-bit. Yeah, Windows 3.1 was 16-bit.
Well,
Windows 2.0 was 16-bit.
Yeah, because every other Windows is broken out here.
32 API became Windows 95. That wasn't the big deal of Windows 95.
Well, then that's probably some weird non-standard browser that had that in its tagline. Yeah, I just recently modified the statistics software to know about Vista and PowerPC versus Intel Max. How to patch that. All right.
Still doing flashes?
We're still very much in flashes. I got a couple hands back there. Lip.
Today's version of Net Pro down.
Right.
You got 2.0 or better, it's a free upgrade. Download the file and update your file.
What is the name of it?
Snaps Pro. Oh.
Screen capture movie type thing. You see a movie on your Mac, you can't save the QuickTime movie. Mm-hmm. You bring it up, the code, Apple Ship 3, I believe what it is.
Yeah.
And you bring it up and you capture movies if you want to capture, or either some kind of DVD or capture can be off thing. But the new version is 2.1.0. You have 2.0 or better, you download the file, like 175 megs. You can upgrade for free. $29 for version 1. But it's a great utility to capture Windows, capture movies. Mm-hmm. You cannot normally capture or save by using the option button.
Or if you want to make a demo something where you have things going on the screen, it is a great tool to capture whatever you're doing. If you're doing a tutorial or something like that. It's something. Let's see here.
It's at AmbrosiaSW.com if you were looking for that.
Okay.
AmbrosiaSW is Ambrosia Software, and it's one of my all-time favorite companies.
The update is going to be University Binary, also working with the Intel Mac too.
Well, that was the main thing when I saw that coming through the news, is that it's now universal, which, these guys took their sweet time about supporting the Intel Max, but hey, this is a very powerful tool if you need something like that. I tend to get away with the built-in screen capture capabilities, but I have it on some older versions of my machines.
You know, what I had at work, I was doing some work on a Sun workstation. But I was asked to make an animation to kind of show it off. It was like a plasma moving around in an electromagnetic bio.
Uh-huh.
So you had all these particles moving around. So I had the X11 window show up on OS 10, and I used Snaps Pro to just capture that window from the Sun workstation.
Right.
So, and then that turned into a movie, which we then put into, at the time, PowerPoint.
Right.
Because this was back in the 90s. So yeah. This program's been around. It's...
Oh, yeah.
It's mature and very powerful.
Absolutely.
Inexpensive,
too. Like $25, I want to say. No, $29.
Well.
But it's a $69.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think $29
upgrade.
Yeah, $69 is...
$69 is the pro version.
It's the pro, the full version. Yeah, and also notice 10.3.9 or later, because any universal binary, you need 10.3.9 or better.
Is there a security concern using Safari 1 as opposed to 2?
It will be for another few months. In other words, if you have the current version for 10.3, it will be supported until 10.5 comes out. After that, you're on your own. Yes.
well,
that
I
is
have no reason to go to 10.4 yet.
Well,
security would really concern
me. Yes. I mean, it will really concern me as the webmaster, too, because our server's still running 10.3. Okay. But until then, of course, I've done a few things above and beyond what Apple does to keep our system secure. Yeah, I'm not running stock Apple software that is exposed to the outside world, because Apple stuff is way out of date, even the security patched stuff. Okay. Remember, Apple has to go through a little bit more quality assurance than, you know, if you build your own software. They have to go through test things, and usually what they give you in terms of software is not the latest greatest. And often not quite as secure. I mean, I tend to see what the security issues are, and I download the uncompiled software, compile it myself. That way I'm sure I've got the patches, because I look at the Apple version numbers, and sometimes, well, I'm not very happy when I see what I get. Yeah?
I have a flash. It entails opening up a web browser and showing you something I bought that is on sale. CircuitCity.com, if you would.
Okay.
And this is taking your advice. Did you mention your Lightning story?
I think sort of in passing.
Okay. Well, it's going to be relevant again, but...
Sooner or later, it'll be relevant to anybody around this part of the country.
So what I did was, let's see. Let's try this. Try searching for APC space 1300 VA. Let's see if that pulls it right up.
Yeah. That's not bad.
Okay, that's what I got. You can go ahead and hit the link and maybe give it a little bit bigger picture, I think, for folks.
Yep.
The thing, and if you don't mind, go ahead and enlarge it one more time by hitting the enlarge key. Or do that. The thing that I thought was neat is that it had actually this display.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually thought that was kind of neat.
Yeah, that is sweet.
You know, and it actually shows you... what your battery status is and stuff, but it also shows you what your actual voltage is.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the retail price for this thing is something like $189 or something like that, like full price. And regular price is $159, and you can see Circuit City has it for $129.
So that's a good price. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, 1300 VA. You know, is kind of an indication of how much battery life you're going to get.
I wish Bob was here, because he's the ultimate authority on these things. However, let me say one or two things about UPS, since I've been using them for 10-plus years on a regular basis. The VA is not an indication how long the thing lasts. It's how much power it can output. Okay, so in other words, it is how much power can the inverter take out of the battery and make into 110 or 117, to be more precise. Okay, so in other words, you can put out that much power, but depending on how much physical amp hour batteries you have on the other end, that power may not last very long. Okay, so when you're buying UPSs, check how much battery capacity, not just how much VA, okay, because I've got some that last a long time but pretty low power, and then there are others that, you know, high power but don't last long because they don't have much battery behind it. So be careful about that. Usually the manufacturers like APC will balance these two pretty well, but they're not necessarily balanced. Okay, so you can have something that can run at a high power for 5 minutes, and there are others that will run at a low power, you know, for hours. But remember, the maximum power output is what they're giving you with the VA. Okay. So you can always use less of that power for longer. So in that sense, what Suman was saying is correct. Okay.
That's a better explanation, though. So, and then if I could get you to open a new tab, get the other thing that I got, go to CompUSA.com.
And below, I recommend you all go to DealNews.com.
DealNews.com.
Yeah, DealNews, yeah, no kidding.
Mm-hmm. Shopping. If it has, you know, Deal RAM, Deal Mac.
Deal Mac.
Yep. Card Hustle.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had them over.
We've had them over, yep.
Yeah. And so they have excellent bargains. You can search on there, too, and also tell you when the special expires. It is supplied by users. You see a bargain somewhere.
Right.
And this time, go ahead and search for APC space, say Surge, Surge Protector.
Well,
and what you can see is you can see the three in the middle, excepting for the one on the left. That with those other three, let's say click on the 11 outlet surge protector. That's what I got because I wanted loads and loads of outlets. And it was suggested to me that surge protectors have a limited life and that after a while they don't have surge protection capability anymore.
Well,
you know,
the hard part is you can't tell.
Yeah, you can't tell.
Some of them have this little idiot light. I'll call it that because it's just as good as the idiot light on your car engine. Okay, after it goes on or off, depending whichever, it's too late. You've already burnt out your engine or you've burnt out whatever's connected to your power strip. Okay. So it doesn't do you much good. But, you know, after I had my event here a little over a month ago, I tossed all my surge protectors. Okay. Because I know they've had all the energy they'll ever handle.
Yeah.
Okay. So I bought a whole new set of surge protectors all around. Yes, I didn't swap my UPSs, but they were behind another layer of surge protectors. Okay, yeah, that did me a lot of good relative to the cable. Not.
So that's the other thing I got.
Yeah.
Now there's one version which does not have data line protections, and then there's another version which
right.
does.
I have both of those. I definitely use the data line protection between the cable modem and the router. That was where I aired before the event, and that cost me a lot of money.
So based on what Maria says, you know, I hadn't replaced my surge protectors in a long time. I know it. And I decide, all right, it happened to him, it could happen to me. So let me just upgrade my equipment.
Right.
And so that's what I did.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely...
Because that's really important. That's why I took the liberty of asking Marius to do this as a flash.
Yeah, this is truly important. This is truly important because I remember... sitting at an HMUG meeting over a decade ago, listening to another former president of the club, Applebaum, after his modem, yes, back then there were such things as modems, got hit and fried his motherboard on his 6100 Power Mac. And that was not a happy situation either. Tom?
Just a quick question. Bob's whole house search.
Mm-hmm.
Those reset?
Well, as I said, that's really a question that Bob would be the right person to answer.
I was kind of hoping he'd be here.
Yeah, well, he.
Let me make a comment on that since I just installed 6 of these on Habitat homes.
Oh, okay.
I asked a question to our senior electrical team leader about those.
Uh huh.
You know, it may be riding. Brand, we use where he buys all the material.
Perhaps. Sure.
If one hits the system, you go out and have to get a new one. It's a one time only.
Right.
But once we get Habitat, they're like $50. Also, I asked a question about how good are they for sensing electronic computer equipment. They said not very good.
Now.
Mainly big things for heat pump, compressor motors, and other things like that. You know, it's not a catch-all.
Yeah.
You have either buy a new home, which that's now becoming the standard, or you retrofit.
Right.
So I still go with something like this for your burial, your computers, or
you know,
your home theater.
I tell you, Bob would be the first one to tell you that one layer is not enough. Okay. The whole house is a good sort of first layer. But between it and your computer, there should be another one that is more sensitive.
Where do you put the whole house?
It's generally put next to your main junction box. Okay. It depends on the manufacturer. But it basically is between the outside world and your house.
But you have to wire it in.
It has to be wired in. This is not something you do as an afternoon chore. Okay, this requires professionals.
Fred, on the new circuit breaker boxes, it's a first gen thing that's designed for that. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know about these built new equipment that you had there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish somebody could summarize
all this at another meeting. Well, this will all be
out. Ask Bob to come back.
Yeah, I think we can definitely ask Bob to reprise his presentation on this, because he's given us a presentation on this in the past.
I think we ought to do that, once in a while. I think
every 2 years or so, it'd probably be a good idea. Because, I mean, we do live in the Southeast, and even though we are in the middle of a drought right now, this is thunderstorm country, and you're going to have these problems, like it or not. But this discussion will be online as a podcast, so everything we've talked about you can go back and listen to. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering how on the ABC, then
right.
The surf touch and APC can go, and you don't know that either.
APC is one of the best manufacturers of surge protectors and UPSs. However, their equivalent deals with the same laws of physics. And if you chew up the energy absorption capability of that surge protector or that uninterruptible power supply, it's just as fried as, the surge protector you might have bought at Walmart, okay, which is a little cheaper. God knows who made it. Okay, but the point is, it can absorb a certain amount of energy, and that's going to be on the box. It says how many joules can it absorb.
Joules is just something like 4,000.
Right. This one is 3,400, for instance. Okay. The greater number it can absorb, the better it's going to protect. But it dissipates this energy by basically taking that energy and destroying something. Okay, some sort of capacitor-like, resistor-like thing that's built into it. And it does not reset. It's not like a circuit breaker that you can reset. If it's fried, it's fried. You buy another one.
And it gets nibbled at, too.
What?
It gets nibbled at. A small surge will take a little bit, and another surge will take a little more.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it all adds up. Mm-hmm. But, when you have a lightning strike 10 foot up front of your door, as I did, it sort of chews up everything that's left in those surge protectors.
Mm-hmm. I misspoke. There's another one that's 11 outlet, that's $44.99, that's over 4,000 joules. I misspoke.
Yeah, okay, it doesn't matter. It's just the larger the number, the better, basically.
You don't know
what?
What's left?
There's
idiot lights, but like Maria said, right? Once the idiot light goes on, it's too late.
Or
right?
Off, and the surge protector, the light's on while it's supposedly giving you protection.
The mine are so old, they don't even have idiot lights, which shows and then, how bad I am.
Then I know some that I had. The first surge protector I ever bought for my dad's computer, back then it was a PC many, many a year ago, its light is still on. I don't trust it. Okay, I know the secretary on campus in the department office has one of the same model. I don't trust it either. Okay, because these things have been there for 15 plus years. Believe me, the light might be on, but I doubt it's protecting anything. I think it's just a fancy outlet.
It's still working.
That is what the instructions say. I don't really want to bet my computer on it, though. Well, if it's flickering off and on, toss it. I mean, that's a good sign that there's something in there that's no longer working. You may just be lucky that it's flickering, but some of the cheap ones, they flicker all the time. But those cheap ones, I consider outlet strips. I would not consider them surge protectors. Okay, if it's not, doesn't have ratings like this on there, how much joules it dissipates, which the cheap ones won't. They'll just say surge protector or something, but they won't really give you any additional information. Consider it just a power strip. Okay, I mean, go get something that's really called a surge protector that tells you how much protection, and hopefully also tells you if it fails, how much the company is willing to reimburse you for your lost equipment. Okay. Oh yeah, you still need to back up. Okay. If you fry your whole computer, APC might buy you a new one. Okay, if you can prove that it was their surge protector and everything was connected correctly. However, your data is still fried. Okay, so make sure you have that backup. Okay. Yeah.
I know we're answering questions on the realm of not a lot of expertise in this room, but the question I always have, you know, especially since your backup hard drive a lot of times is plugged in, at least on my main desktop versus my laptop, always unplug it after the backup. But suppose you're protected real good on the electrical side, mm-hmm. but you're on cable for your high speed.
Well, that's how I got caught.
And that can ricochet right back into the system.
Well, it took out my cable modem, my router, my gigabit Ethernet switch, and three Ethernet cards, a video card, and a monitor. Okay. And I thought it had taken out a DVD burner. But it turns out it only was captured by Parallels. And when I pressed on eject, it didn't eject. But when I told Parallels to give it back to Mac OS, it worked just fine. But I was a little concerned there about that, too. And, of course, it got one of my TVs and telephone and so on. But the way I have things set up now is that I have, because, remember, cable modems are very flaky. They want as much signal as possible. I was talking to David about this after the last meeting, and the way that they have it set up at his house is that they actually have an amplifier on the cable before it goes through a surge protector. Okay. I don't have such a creature in my house, but that's how you boost the signal enough that the signal loss of the surge protector isn't going to reduce the signal on the cable modem to the point where you don't have any usable internet. Okay, because my signal is pretty poor to begin with. That's the reason I didn't have a surge protector on coming into the cable modem on the coax. Well, so my solution to that is I'm renting my cable modem. I don't care if it gets fried. I let MediaCom worry about that. Okay, so what I've done is I put one of these APC jobs between my cable modem and my router. So if the cable modem gets fried, well, that's fine. I'll just go get a new one. But my router, since now I have a nicer one, I'd like to keep, thank you very much. Okay, so I sort of firewall at that point between the cable modem and the router. And that's really, I wish I had done that before. But you learn these lessons the hard way.
That's a separate device?
What?
For the coax cable.
Well, if you look at this guy right here, there are the plugs for the coax. Okay, higher end surge protectors will have coax. Even higher end will have data. Okay, you got to be careful though when you buy them. There are a lot have telephone, few have Ethernet. Okay, so you have to kind of look at that.
Just offering to help you.
Yep. Okay.
There, up there. Are like phone line kind of things. And there's one input and two output phone lines, and then up there are data lines, input and output data lines, right. For example, on this one.
Yeah, yeah.
How large is that?
Yeah, it's about a foot.
I've seen
like
bigger
that.
Ones. I've
it's
seen bigger ones. We have one on campus that's really designed for sort of a media center thing. It's this big. Okay. Because remember, you've got all these power adapters, and they need space to breathe. Not only physically so we can plug them in, but also because of the heat they give off. You know, so it's not uncommon for these outlet strips, surge protectors, to be very large. But these APC ones aren't really all that humongous. You can hide those pretty well.
And Bob has mentioned before that he has had, you know, his clients or whatever mentioned that they use APC and universally good experiences.
So I've been using APC for 10, 15 years. Even though this latest round of surge protectors, I bought some cheaper ones as well.
I'm still concerned in that every time you get a little blip, it sets all of your clocks off.
Not necessarily. Well, yes and no. Yes, anything other than a nice sinusoidal potential is not good. Okay, your computer wants the same potential at the same frequency. Well, okay, they're not as picky about frequency because they make DC out of it. But it needs to be regular. So anything above or anything below is not good. Surge protector will get you the above part. A UPS does you the below part. And that's why Suman was pointing out, and let me tab over here, that having this nice indicator that says 117 volts is useful. Because if you're somewhere where you're getting less than 117 volts, means your power company is not giving you the standard voltage. And your equipment is designed to go a little bit below, but if it goes a good bit below, your mileage may be rather variable. Okay, so I mean, if you're getting 90 some odd volts, odds are your computer may not like it. Okay, your laptop says, "Oh, I've got a built-in UPS. It's called my battery." Okay, but your desktop doesn't have such a thing, and it may just say, "Sorry, Buster, I'm not going to work."
Well, I'm thinking about all these little blips are going to nibble away at your jewels. You'd have no idea how many are going.
Let me be a little bit more precise. Okay, there's one other thing that will show up when you go into the specs of these things. And I wish it would tell me here, but it doesn't. There's something called a clipping voltage. Okay, that is the voltage above which it starts doing something. And most surge protectors, that's 330 volts. Okay. So that's three times normal. So anything in terms of glitches below that, it's not going to affect it. Okay. It's going to, if it goes above that, then it starts kicking in. Okay. Most equipment can handle that over voltage fairly well. Okay. But if you've got very sensitive equipment, you have to buy a more expensive surge protector that narrows that range of allowed voltages. But hey, the UPS does that. That's why they're a little bit more expensive, but they control the power. But again, I'm sort of jumping on what Bob is the expert on. I'm just sort of, well,
a burnt user.
Yeah. Yeah, no, Bob really knows the details a lot better than I do on this.
But anyway, this is what I really wanted to mention during my flash.
Yeah,
I'm glad
yep.
I got you a chance to talk a bit.
Yep, yep. Well, any other flashes?
Yep.
Yeah?
I've got a Pismo.
Right.
The battery, just recently bought a battery on the internet.
Uh-huh.
I've been using it maybe a month and a half.
Yeah.
2 months. No problems.
Uh-huh.
Run it on battery, recharge.
Right.
It has taken a drop down to 35%.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't want to come back up?
It doesn't want to come back up.
Mm.
Pulled it, run it down. Recharge, mm-hmm. and it gets up to 35. Am I basically dead in the world of that?
I'm trying to remember how the power manager works on there. It's, I'm, I don't know. Lip.
You take out the battery.
Yeah, right?
The reset switch. Is that what you're talking about?
There's something like that. Yeah.
You hold down the reset switch for a few seconds. We can try looking it up. But yeah. You can look it up on Apple's site.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pismo PowerBook is what he said.
I love my Pismo. It's a great computer. That was my PowerBook prior to this one.
Reset Power Manager. You can look it up. But
yeah, well,
Marius, I mean, do you think the battery might just have been one charge cycle too many?
No. If he's had that battery just for about a month, was it used?
Only a month. I didn't hear that.
Was it used or was that brand new?
I expect it was used.
Ah, well, then it's hard to say. You're running what operating system on it?
10.9.
Okay, now. 10. I wish I knew the Kung Fu part here off the top of my head, but there is a tool that can...
10.4,
even better. There is a tool available that goes into the data on your computer that can tell you how many cycles are on that battery.
Wow.
It puts things out in XML. Now, let me see here if there is a better way of doing this. And maybe, just keeping my fingers crossed, that perhaps System Profiler can get this information too. I'm not sure, but it is the same. Okay, here, let's scroll. See this battery information? This is under System Profiler Power. Notice cycle count. That's that information that you can also get from the command line, but this is infinitely more convenient because I forget the incantation to get there. And it tells you, you know, what capacity it has, full charge. If that is significantly less than what the label says, there's a problem. But the other thing is, what's that cycle count? If that is actually stored on the battery. Okay, so it's not something that the computer stores. It's the battery. It has some chips on it. And so if that cycle count is significantly high, then that battery may very well be dead. But if it's low, then you might want to just reset the battery.
When you say significantly high, about where?
Oh my God. I don't know what the number is, how many cycles these things are good for.
How many times it's gone to zero or what?
It's just how many times it's been discharged and recharged. But it doesn't have to be all the way down to zero. But I'm thinking sort of in the order of 150 or so, if memory serves me. The greater that number, less likely it's good. Yeah, but mine is, as you can see, still fairly low for a four-year-old computer. Tells you how much I use this one. Not too much. My work laptop is probably close to having a dead battery if I were to look at it, since I teach it with that 5 days a week during the semester. Any other flashes?
Just full of flashes today. Got one more.
Sure.
Downloading the WWDC pitch.
Right.
To a 20-inch flat panel. No audio.
Oh, really?
I've got the Pismo, so I was able to sync them, get sync from the Pismo, and get the viewing on the 20-inch.
Oh, that's a good solution.
And ended up that the... the 20-inch, I said, okay, maybe something's happened. So I turned on iTunes and played some music out of iTunes.
Just fine.
So the audio is fine.
Right.
But never have been able to get
it. What version of QuickTime do you have installed?
Well, you get information from software update. It's current.
Okay, so you have got 7.16, which is the current version. Huh, that's curious. Obviously, you check the sound settings in your player, the overall sound settings for the computer. Only thing that sort of comes to mind is make sure that...
And I'm wondering if it's tied into this Morning in America Bennett problem.
Huh? I mean, you're streaming this, right? Or did you download the whole thing?
I downloaded.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I believe I did.
I didn't know it was available for download.
Well, you can always right-click on it and copy. You know, I mean, there's some files you can't, but others you can.
Only if you have Pro.
Yeah, if you have. Yeah. Well, you'd be surprised. If you control-click on an MP3 file, you'll download it. You don't have to have Pro for that. But I sure prefer having Pro regardless. I do, but I had this problem with a colleague yesterday. He wanted to download some lectures from on nanotechnology, and his machine, he didn't have Pro. And, you know, I told him, well, just, you know, after you play it in your browser, just click on it and say save. He said, oh, that doesn't work. I said, aha, you don't have Pro. And I just said, go back to the link and control-click on it and say download that file. Okay, now let's see here. We wanted to go to sound, didn't we? Okay. Output. Well, don't see any particular options above the obvious that are there. Huh. Well, obviously, you want to make sure you don't have mute on like I do.
Try it. Logging in as a different user, and when you start,
that's
straws by doing stuff like that.
Quite honestly, Suman is very much correct, and that's also something I think I want to advise people to have. You set up your Mac, and especially if you're the only user on it, you have one account and one account only. And you know, I'm probably just as guilty of that. So, you know, do as I say, don't do as I do. Let me go into System Preferences and look on Accounts. Well, no, in this case, I did follow my own advice. There's just this other user called Justin Case. Just in case. And notice that account is administrative, so it has full privileges. So if my main account has a problem, I can log in as Justin, and I don't have anything installed above and beyond what Apple defaults into the account. So if there's something in my personal settings, somewhere in the library preferences in my account, that is causing me problems, if I go in as Justin, I shouldn't have that problem. Okay, so it has a full set of clean preferences, and it is sometimes a very good thing to have to debug problems.
You handle one more flash,
Maurice?
Sure. You with it?
We don't have that much presentation, so this is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, we can do an all-flash meeting.
I've witnessed and run productive meetings like that in the past.
Yep.
You mentioned a router and a gigabit switch.
Mm-hmm.
I have recently been thinking that, I want to upgrade my network to gigabit.
Uh-huh.
I think all my machines are gigabit, mm-hmm. And I've been thinking about getting a router or a switch. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want to talk about the difference and maybe talk about what you got?
Okay. First of all, let's back up a little bit in time here. In the olden days, you would get a router. That would be something like a Linksys or in the Apple world, maybe an AirPort of the first generation. It would have one cable that goes to your cable modem or your DSL modem, and one cable that goes to your computer. And then, of course, wireless, or maybe not. Okay. So in other words, your router had one function only, to talk to the internet versus the intranet, your personal home LAN, local area network. And so basically what it was doing, they still do this, is hiding what's inside from what's outside. It's a firewall, but it also takes the address, the single address of your router, and translates it in however many addresses you have if your computer's inside your home network. Okay? If you have a single computer, the router isn't really doing anything in terms of routing.
But if you have multiple computers, as some of us do, then it allows them all to talk to the internet. Now, if I have a router, that first generation that has a single cable, how do I connect more than one computer to it? Well, I need some sort of device called a hub. Well, that's what they used to call them. And hub is sort of the predecessor of the switch, which we'll talk about here in a moment. It's basically a little box that has a bunch of Ethernet connectors on it. And what hub does is it takes data packets that come in and sends them back out to all other devices attached to it. It's very dumb, and it's also very slow. Hubs tend to be 10 megabits. Okay, not 100 megabits or a gigabit. Now, the problem is, every time a packet goes in there, it has to go out to everybody else. Not good. A lot of overhead. Okay. So if you want to increase the bandwidth, you go from a hub to a switch. Switch looks at the packet and says, hey, this is from this computer and wants to go to that computer or the router or whatnot. And it routes it directly to that next device. So if you have, say, an 8-port switch, you can have four simultaneous conversations, in quotes, going on at the same time. So if your switch is 100 megabits, you can have a throughput of 400 megabits at one point. Okay? Well, that's better than a hub, because a hub, you know, 10 in, 10 out. That's always going to be. It's not going to be 40 out. But of course, as time has gone on, 100 megabits isn't the hot speed anymore. It's a gigabit, 1,000 megabits. So, again, that's just what is recommended, because pretty much every Mac made these days has a gigabit Ethernet on it. Didn't say everyone, because I think there are one or two that still don't, like the minis and that sort of thing. But nonetheless, it allows you to connect as many computers as you have. So the second part of the question, I think, was what am I using? And after,
so you got your cable modem.
Right.
And
before I had my little lightning strike, I had an Apple AirPort Extreme of the first generation, that is to say 802.11G AirPort Extreme, which was that kind that had one input and one output. So it didn't have a built-in switch or a hub. Now, what I bought to replace it, and this is not necessarily the recommended thing, certainly Apple prefers to be, I bought the current generation 802.11N AirPort Extreme as a replacement. There are a couple reasons why I prefer Apple's, and the main one is better support, better configuration utilities. I've pounded my head against the wall many a time with routers made by others like Linksys or
V-Link or Netgear.
You know, my parents had an Asante, and it had a problem. There's nothing we could do about it except buy a new one, you know. And getting firmware updates into routers other than Apple's can be a painful experience. I remember putting update into a Linksys I had, wired Linksys I had, before I got my first AirPort, the B kind, and I had to use a utility called TFTP, Trivial FTP, which is built into OS X, all right. But all the tools that you get from Linksys are Windows only. So you have to sort of hack how you do this. Not fun. You got a firmware upgrade from Apple. It tells you there's a new firmware for that router. It pushes it up very easy. Oh yeah, by the way, I think that's a point in itself. Did I say firmware updates? Routers are little computers. And they have operating systems just as much as a real computer, quote-unquote real computer. Guess what? operating systems contain bugs, regardless who writes them. So the firmware on your router occasionally needs to be upgraded to fix security issues or just plain old bugs. And so just by buying a router and plugging it in doesn't mean you're done with it. Okay, for your security, your computer security, you have to make sure it's up to date just as much as you keep your Mac up to date. Okay, so if you have a router that's been around for a few years, you might want to double check if you haven't missed half a dozen updates to it. Okay, it's definitely a security issue. I keep mine up to date at all times.
So you got the Airport Extreme. Mm-hmm. Now the Airport Extreme has built in a hub, right?
It's a switch.
It is a switch.
But
it's a 10100 switch.
10100, that's the problem.
Okay.
Now why do I say it's a problem? It's not a problem if you're connecting to the internet, because the internet is not a gigabit affair. Okay, the internet, if you're lucky, is an 8 megabit affair. Okay. However, your home network connecting gigabit laptops to gigabit desktops is a gigabit affair. So really, truly, I only use one connection on the LAN side of my airport, namely the one that goes to my gigabit switch. And oh yeah, it does not matter that the Airport Extreme is running 100 megabits. Okay, the switch can go 10 megabits, 100 megabits, or 1,000 megabits. Okay, it just negotiates the speed that's appropriate for what's connected in at the other end. Okay, so it's just because you have something, you know, like I have an old Beige G3, which is currently not hooked up, but if it were, it has a 10 megabit Ethernet. Okay, I can plug it in. It works fine with a gigabit switch. Just 10 megabits. It's going to run at 10 megabits. You know, but everything else on the switch is running a gigabit. It's not like the wireless part. Now, I think that's another story. Since we brought it up, let's talk about it. Okay. I mentioned I've gone through three generations of wireless. I started with B for my Pismo, and I had a little Linksys box that allowed me to move my G3 into the living room and still talk to it wirelessly at 10 megabits. And, that is the slow speed, right? What was it 11 megabits or something like that? Okay. Then along came 802.11g, the old flavor Airport Extreme. I wish Apple would have come up with a new name for N, but nonetheless, that's 54 megabits in a good day, okay? And they're both in the same frequency. So in other words, if I whip out my Pismo, which I would have a hard time doing because it's sitting in Austria, but if I were, okay, it would take my G router, which is now very well fried, but would have taken my G router down to B speeds. I would be getting 11, not 54. Okay. Now that I have an N, it would, with its even higher speeds, it would still kick everything down to B. Okay. So in other words, if you have a home network that where you're going to use B computers or some device that uses B along with G or N, you might want to do what David does. Have multiple access points. One set up on one channel for B, another one set up another channel for G or N. That way your fast devices go fast, your slow devices go at their lovely speed. Okay. Now, am I going to do that? Not really, because I don't have any B devices left at my house. But I still have a B generation airport, so that's sitting on campus right now as a loaner to the department conference room. But if I had some B device I wanted to hook up, I'd bring that back home.
So the last question that I had was about the gigabit switch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much do you spend? You know, what did you have suggestions on model or anything else like that?
I actually did the DealMac thing.
Okay. I have a need for a gigabit switch of greater than 5 ports. Okay. So I fried an 8-port switch, and I want to replace it with an 8-port switch. So I found a deal for, well, $30. Okay. If you go out there, you can get a 5-port switch for $30, but you're going to have a hard time finding an 8-port one, because they usually cost about $70, $80. Okay. But I went with a Netgear. I've had no problems with those, with that brand in the past. But, you know, Linksys works, Asante work. I mean, switch, you know, it's not that fancy an item. You know, I had, you know, in the meantime, after I burnt out the old switch, I used an old 100 megabit 5-port switch that I had lying around. I actually have a couple of those lying around the house. One that I bought also, I think, through a DealMac type of thing. That's so small that I can put it in my laptop case if I go to a meeting where I need to switch, connect things up with a small switch. But I don't carry it anymore, because the days where we plug things up seem to have gone. Everybody is online wirelessly right now, so who needs wire? But you know what? That is an interesting point also. You know, when my parents wired router went dead last year, they went to the store wanting to buy a wired router because they don't have any wireless device in the house. Okay, my mother has a G4 tower, my dad has a G4 iMac. No need. Everything is wired. There's no need for having a wireless network. You think a wired router would be cheaper than a wireless? Uh-uh. The wired was twice as expensive. So they bought a wireless, and I went online. Or well, I talked them through setting it up that it's fully protected, because that particular model, they ended up, for whatever reason, you can't turn the wireless off. But I don't know why that's so. That's really brilliant, because other models you can, but this one you can't. So I just made sure they had full encryption turned on and good passwords. You know, so yeah, there's signals out there, but nobody's going to get on because they don't have the proper information to get on it. You know, but it is interesting that we are more and more going wireless. Even though personally, I prefer having my gigabit. Thank you. You know, if I'm moving big files around, even N is not the way to go. I mean, if I get an Apple TV, which I may or may not. I think I'm going to put a long cable between my office and my living room, because it's just better connectivity. Even though I have N already, I still probably am going to end up connecting it by wire. No? Any other questions? My gosh, I've talked so long the computer's fallen asleep. Well, if not, let me bring up a couple things. Well, going once, going twice. Yeah, Tom.
After this is over, I'm having trouble using Microsoft Windows and getting on the internet.
Uh-huh. From your Mac?
From my Mac.
You're using under Bootcamp or Parallels? Or VMware? Parallels? Huh. I don't have a problem.
Okay.
I just installed it and it works.
After this is over,
yeah, we'll have a look at it.
It keeps saying you're not wired on an Ethernet.
Oh,
the internet.
Well, that may be. I mean, on mine, I have it installed on the Mac Pro, and it, of course, goes wired. It doesn't go wireless. Okay. But quite honestly, sort of off the top, I would want to look at my network settings. It should show up a couple items there, but also in the system your preferences. If you bring up your network settings here, there are a couple two or three more items that show up that are related to Parallels.
Okay.
Because basically what's happening with Parallels is it sets up another router on your Mac. The Parallels virtual machines are hidden behind that. Okay. And that's one thing that annoys me about Parallels, because I've yet to figure out how I can get into the virtual machines from login externally. Okay, I mean, you don't want to particularly log into Windows, but I also have other operating systems installed under Parallels besides Windows that are Unix-based. And I sure would like to be able to telnet into those, or SSH, really. Okay. And I haven't figured out how to do that yet, because God knows what kind of configuration foolishness has to be done there. So, but anyway, that's another story. Yeah, Lip.
One last point. Anybody who's not really or wants to use IDVD 6, Apple provides a beautiful PDF file, introduction to IDVD, how to use it.
There's
tips in there, probably 45 pages.
Oh, really?
It's a good little on the Apple site. Anybody who wants it to use next level of activity
and
IDVD, PDF, fantastic little
thing. All right, so obviously everybody can get to Apple's website, but I pulled down the quick movie clips that they have embedded there, run them, and we'll talk about them a little bit. Now, you might, if you came in early, you might have heard some of my comments and Billy's comments about the keynote at the Worldwide Developers Conference. And they probably, if you heard them, you probably noticed that we weren't exactly over-enthused about them. The amount of information that was divulged to the public, even the techno-geek public, was minimal. Okay, a number of these clips that they showed, or items that Steve demonstrated at the keynote, we knew from last year's Worldwide Developer Conference. There are no news at all. Okay, so a few things that he showed were news, and that basically matters of look of the desktop. And I'm consciously not running the sound. Here's you notice the menu bar. It's now transparent. I'm going to try to figure out how to turn that off as soon as possible. The dock is now a little bit more 3D looking, which is cute, not overly helpful, but hey, what's this? Came and went so fast. Let me just go through this again, because, oh yeah, let me stop that and do this a little bit more manually. Come on. Okay, what's this? It's called a stack. Okay. And it's basically, you know, if I go here, I put the folder in the dock, I click on it, and up comes what's in it. So you can compare, use just dragging a folder to the dock and clicking on it, having a contextual menu, to what Leopard's doing. It has this new tool called a stack, which just explodes things up. It's eye candy. Is it really useful? This is another way of doing it. Well, we'll all be the judge of that. I'm not completely convinced yet. Okay, but yes, it is a little, it's cute, you know, and you know, you can go and do some searches and so forth, drag things into there, and automatically you get a stack. So it's really not much different than the contextual menu I have for my applications folder. Okay. So I don't know. I'm not overly convinced of this one.
Oh, you're a curmudgeon.
Oh yeah. I don't know. We'll find out real soon when I start using Leopard. Finder looks a little different. And actually, let me stop this as well. There are a couple quick things that they scroll by real fast that people, even those that watched the keynote, really didn't notice. First of all, Steve talked about something called Back to My Mac. Okay, so what is that all about? If you have a .Mac account, and just out of curiosity, how many of us do have one of those? Wow, that's actually a greater percentage than I would have guessed. I'm seeing about a quarter to a third here of the group assembled. If you have a .Mac account and Leopard, you can use the service called Back to My Mac. Essentially, what you do is you register your computer to talk to Apple Server, and as it does so, Apple Server knows the IP address of your computer, say, your home computer. Remember, we were just talking about routers, right? Routers what? It's a firewall. Means normally you can't get back in to talk to your computer. But with Back to My Mac, I can go and log on to my home computer, grab files from it, from anywhere, if I have that service. Okay. But hey, wait a second, there's something else here. Share screen. Okay. I heard people groaning and griping that Apple said they're going to do that using iChat Theater and so forth. No. It's now hidden in the Finder. It's called screen sharing. You can share the screen from that computer at home with that computer, like your laptop here at the meeting, and look at what's going on at your home computer. Regardless of firewalls, that's the neat part. For example, if you have a DSL line rather than a cable modem, your IP address may change every 10 minutes. My parents out in California have that problem. Okay. But with this, Apple's computer still knows, and you still can connect in. So if I have a service call from California, well, guess what? With this, I can get into my parents' computers and deal with the problem, rather than spending 2 hours trying to tell them how to do it themselves. So, neat feature. Now, the look and feel here, well, okay, so they stole that from iTunes. You know, nothing much overly different here. You can scroll your icons. Wow. Ah, well, wait a second. Here's something new. Also stolen from iTunes, sort of. It's the cover flow for files. It can open, of course, lots of different file formats, including movies and PDFs and Word documents and whatnot, and you can quickly preview it. Well, again, Suman will accuse me of being a curmudgeon on this one as well.
But it's an endearing characteristic.
It's cute. It's cute. I don't consider it overly useful, but it's cute. I'll give it that. But we'll see another use for it here in another clip here, because there's another thing called, let me just open this in a different format. That way you can see what the file name is. Okay, let's go to Quick Look. I'm not going to do this quite in the order, alphabetical order here. This cover flow business actually works very well along with this new tool called Quick Look. It's sort of a advanced replacement of Preview. Preview, you double-clicked, it opened an application, you could look at the contents of a file. Well, here, you just press a key or click on the Quick Look icon, and you can pop up files, and you can go inside like a keynote presentation. You can browse page by page what's in there or look at a movie without actually having to go and open up QuickTime or whatnot. So it's kind of nice. Again, it's sort of an incremental improvement over what we've had trying to preview things within the Finder. Apropos, another Finder enhancement, and this one I definitely like. It's called Spaces. Now, I've been using virtual desktops on my Macs for, I don't know, 5-6 plus years. Codec virtual desktop is what I use. Codec, excuse me. And it does the same thing as this, except Apple, of course, in their way, does it one better. Okay, it is much more seamlessly integrated, and navigation between the different spaces, virtual desktops, if you will, is smoother. You can drag them around. You can't do that, for instance, with Codec. So Very nice. And you can have different backgrounds for each space and so on and so forth. You can have a maximum of 16 spaces. Well, okay.
Even that with a small work. Screen, boy, you could have a lot of
Real estate.
A small screen, right?
Yeah, well, on my machine, I have, by default, 9 spaces. Nice. So, you know, that should do. But, you know, when you have a big screen like a 30-inch, that's a lot of real estate. Currently, I don't have that installed in Mac Pro. But with Leopard, I will, obviously. So that's spaces. That is really useful, especially if you're running a little 15-inch or smaller PowerBook. Okay, there, this is really useful. Well, let's look at Time Machine. There's no news here. He demoed that last year. But a good external hard drive, or better yet, a RAID array, allows you to keep backups and in a transparent manner. It looks at the changes in your file system, and you can go back in time, look at what was there. If you deleted a file or modified a file, you can go back and look at what you had at a certain time in the past. If that version is better than what you got, or if you deleted it, you can go and bring things back. See, the key is you need an extra hard drive. Okay. So when Leopard Go comes out, I think most of us are going to be running out the door and grabbing ourselves a large external hard drive.
What do you mean by large? 500 gigabytes.
Well, large is all a function of what you do. For my parents, large might be 100 gigs. For me, it might be 2 or 3 terabytes. Okay. It really depends on what you do. How often do the files on your hard drive change? For example, I compile a lot of open source software. Okay, so therefore, my hard drive might be changing a lot, and I can fill up the terabyte drive fairly quickly. Okay, but somebody that just writes a Word document or two, like my dad, as he's writing some scientific papers, I transferred all his stuff from his G3 to his G4 iMac, and it was, you know, a couple tens of megs, you know. And so in his case, he can get away with you know, 250 gig drive, and it'll probably last him till the day he dies.
Will this data in that slave, will it roll off the end after a certain period?
No, it'll, the drive will just be full. Then you just buy another drive.
So you never lose what?
Well, if the hard drive dies, yes, you do.
Yeah.
but all the files, any file you ever change, you still have that old version there. So you can go back in time to any change, drag things back into the present from the past. That's why it's called Time Machine, you know, and get at that old version. So if you accidentally deleted something, no biggie. But I think the point is taken, though. You got to be careful. That hard drive is only as good as it is. So even with Time Machine, you got to be careful about what kind of hard drive. That's why I was sort of saying RAID array. Okay. Now, ideally, well, first of all, let me back up. I just threw that word out there. Everybody know what a RAID array is? That's what I thought. Okay, so that's a redundant array of inexpensive disks. Okay. Keyword redundant. Okay. In order to be redundant, you have to have more than one drive. Okay. Ideally, you want to have 3 or more drives that store the data. There are RAID, and boy, somewhere in the distant past, there was something, a talk I gave on this at HMUC, but basically, there are different levels of RAID. There's RAID 0, which is a misnomer. It really isn't RAID at all.
What are you saying?
R-A-I-D.
R-A-I-D.
Yeah.
There's RAID 0, which is called striping. It just means it writes the data onto two drives. But it spreads the data over two drives. It doesn't do two copies. So if one of those two drives fails, sorry, you're out of luck. Okay, then there's RAID 1, which is my favorite version because I'm not rich enough to do anything higher, means I have two drives that have exactly the same identical data on it. If one goes bad, go to the store, buy another drive as big or larger as the one that went bad, plug it in there, it reconstitutes itself from the good copy. Another one dies, well, do it over again. Then there's RAID 5, which requires three or more drives, which does have some more advanced algorithms for parity checking, checksums, and stuff like that, that is a little bit smarter about spreading the risk around, which is preferred. Okay, but when you start talking about things like Time Machine, RAID Array is the way to go. It's more expensive because you're buying a larger box, more hard drive mechanisms. However, if your data is worth something to you, it should be. It's well worth the investment.
I agree with Marius in that sense. I mean, I was about to say that a 500 gigabyte USB external hard drive can be had for $135 right now.
Well, did you buy that deal that we saw last time?
Which one was that?
That 1 terabyte for $228?
No, for $282. No, I didn't do that.
Yeah, I didn't do that either. Well, I looked at the reviews.
Okay, what did you see?
They were not good, so I decided to pass on that deal.
But what did you see that was kind of a downer with the review?
The people that had bought that model drive had some bad experiences with it, dying. Yeah. So, see, this is another thing, you know, hard drive mechanisms. You can get up to 1 terabyte in a single hard drive spindle. But if you talk to the experts, and there's this one fellow by the name of Steve Gibson, who's actually also a security expert, but his main deal in life is to write a piece of software called SpinWrite, which is sort of an Microsoft end of things software. But nonetheless, it restores hard drives that are near death, okay, or at least under other circumstances be considered near death. And he is, when I listen to his security podcast, and you know, when he talks to Leo Laporte about hard drives, he is really queasy about these large hard drives because they store the data so densely, and they use a lot of error correction, that he is not very comfortable with the way the data is stored. So quite honestly, I'd rather have a bunch of medium-sized drives, medium these days is like a 250 gig, rather than a 750 or a giga or a terabyte drive, just because of the aerial density of the data. You know, so, and anyway, if you lose a terabyte drive, that's a lot of data. So I'd rather have a bunch of 500 gig or 250 gig drives than one of these 750. Well, I shouldn't be talking. I have two 750s sitting in my Mac Pro, but but they're in a RAID array. Okay, so if one goes wacko, it's not quite the end of all things. But I certainly wouldn't want to have one of those drives being my one single non-rated, non-backed up drive, because then you're sort of playing with fire.
I saw an article about holographic.
Yeah, well, okay. Holographic, I can speak to that because I do holography and optical data storage. And the answer to that is, don't hold your breath. It's neat technology, but it's not practical technology. Okay, to make a three-dimensional volume hologram to store data, the more data you store, the longer you need time to expose it. The more images you store, exponentially the time goes up. And as you're storing the data, you're erasing previously stored data partially. So your signal-to-noise ratio goes up. So the trustworthiness of your old data goes down. It's slow, it's noisy, and it's not reliable. It's lovely in theory, but not practical. You know, it's just as much as my colleagues and I were talking about optical computing 10, 15 years ago. Well, we don't anymore. We talk about optically assisted computing, okay? But quite honestly, there's some, you know, some fractional dimensions between a true three-dimensional volume hologram and a two-dimensional data storage device like a CD or DVD. Okay. And that may very well, sometime along the line, be used to increase the data storage density over the dots and dashes that we're using currently. But I don't expect a major revolution on this anytime soon. It may happen, but I read the optical journals, the optics journals, and I have not seen anything that's earth-shattering any in there. So I wouldn't hold my breath. And anyway, you know, with the new generation of DVDs, the HD and Blu-ray, 50 gigs. I mean, please. I haven't routinely started using regular DVDs to store data because most of the stuff I store is smaller than that. So I still burn many more regular CDs than DVDs. Quick iChat. I mentioned about iChat Theater. They've tweaked it a little bit more. Remember, we talked about Quick Look. Any application that is in Quick Look compatible, any data type really, can be brought up in iChat. So here they're showing we're showing a slideshow, but here's another deal. You can do a green screen without a green screen. Okay, let me back up for those of you that are not video professionals. What's a green screen? Well, you know, the weatherman every night giving his weather forecast, right, has this nice graphical display behind him of the weather charts. And for some reason, he's standing in front of it. Well, he's standing in front of a wall that's painted green, okay, and the computer takes that green and substitutes in whatever is in the computer screen, okay. Well, most of us do not have a studio with a green wall on it. So Apple does something simple, really simple. You get out of the picture, take a picture of it, out of the room, go back in it. And now your computer knows what the background looks like. It can substitute what it knows to be the background relative to the foreground, namely you. And so now you can have anything in the background, be it the Eiffel Tower or a bunch of fish as they had in the keynote. It's cool. Somebody is listening to the HMUD podcast.
Yes.
I recognize that somewhere. iChat, because it works with Quick Look, is a cool way of sharing through the net as you're having a video conference. So that's kind of neat. How about mail? David talked about playing with mail last time at the meeting, and its main new feature, as far as Apple's concerned, is this business of stationery. Again, I guess I must be the old school guy here. I hate HTML mail, and this is just another excuse to have more HTML mail. Email should be text only by law. It is inefficient. It fills up your mailbox because remember, our mailbox, even if you have a Gmail account, is not infinite. You know, and the more people put pictures in there and all sorts of other resources, the more quickly it fills up. And so, not so hot. Another thing, though, that you may have noticed, let me stop this here momentarily. What's this? RSS. Okay. RSS in Tiger lives in Safari. But notice here RSS can also live in Mail. Isn't that interesting? And I find it actually a logical consequence because those of you that use Entourage will realize that Entourage can read news groups. Oh my God, Usenet. Now talk about old school. I haven't touched Usenet in years, but I used to. Okay. And RSS is sort of the modern replacement of Usenet in a way. And so being able to go through RSS type posting using your mail is actually a logical tool because it's designed to deal with lists, whereas your browser really, Safari really isn't as much designed for that, even though, you know, they put a fairly nice interface to it, but it's not really the logical and efficient place to do it. So that's kind of, I think that is sort of the cuter, or, well, cute is maybe not the right, the more useful addition to mail. Now, I haven't played with mail. Obviously, I don't have Leopard. I'm not one of these rich developer types that went to WWDC. But, you know, we're going to have to sort of be a little bit more patient for another few months before this all comes out. Now, just sort of for my information, how many of you are going to get Leopard when it first comes out? Okay, so I see sort of the usual crowd there of folks that'll go be there the day it gets released, and then there's the rest of the people that are going to say, oh, well, I'll get it when they no longer support Tiger and 10.6, whatever name of that kitty cat it'll be, comes out, right? Well, I'm going to have it the first day. But
I'll just guess, links.
Well, there are a bunch of other cats still out there that are available. We haven't had a line yet either.
I know they've reserved Lynx and Bobcat.
We're getting smaller and smaller here. Pretty soon we'll have a standard house cat. Yeah.
How long delay do you think will be between, you know, like I'm getting this fall, I'm going to probably upgrade my laptop.
Uh-huh. Right.
What do you expect the delay of getting a refurbished laptop with Leopard on it?
Ooh, that's hard to call. There's no way of telling.
You know, since we get one,
not
you
the
know,
fall.
This fall, and then turn around and buy a Leopard.
Not the fall.
Yeah, it's going to take a few months. In other words, whenever Apple comes out with a new model that has Leopard pre-installed, then you have to add it a few months before the first ones go through refurbishment. And only then will they show up. But if you get a refurb of the prior model, it's still going to have Tiger on it. You know, so I would expect, I think Suman is right, probably sometime next year, spring, is my guess. You know, but remember, Apple, you said laptop, right? Apple has just revved both MacBook and MacBook Pros in the last couple months. And so with Apple's typical cycle, that means the next model will come out, maybe Macworld San Francisco, or plus or minus a month. Okay, and so that would indicate to me, you know, that's January, end of January typically when these things come out, add another 3 months. We're talking next year, April, you know. Quite honestly, I just would buy a copy of Leopard. You know, buy the computer and buy yourself a copy of Leopard rather than waiting for some machine to come out that has it pre-installed. It's not worth waiting that long.
Isn't the high-end 15 and MacBook Pro supposed to come with Leopard?
Access no.
Leopard?
Well,
I saw something.
It will come when Leopard is available.
Yeah.
But how quickly Apple is going to change that, you know, it's all a function of how much is in inventory. You know, machines that are manufactured before the date, whatever that happens to be in October, will still have Tiger on it. Then there will be some magic date where Apple says, okay, now everything comes pre-installed with Leopard. But machines that were manufactured before that date will still have Tiger even after Leopard is introduced. I mean, that's always been that way. So, you know, I'm not going to be buying a computer with Leopard pre-installed probably for quite a while.
No, I got the impression that you could have, when Leopard came out, it could come out to your machine at cost. I don't know if that's the case.
Quite honestly, Apple has done this in different ways in the past. Sometimes they would give you a coupon and you could get it for the price of the media. Sometimes you were out of luck. Well, given that people are taking off, I think
Let's go eat.
Let's call it a day.
Thank you, Marius.